I was actually asked by Peter Nemetz, whom most of you will know, is the one indispensable person for this organization who arranges the program for us. Peter asked me to stay again. Peter, can you stand up and take a bow? You may have seen Peter outside just now taking your money. And I don't know, how many of you, just out of interest, were members last year? Ah, it was a good showing. How many of you had a chance? Two. For those of you who haven't yet had a chance to do so, I would like to go through the old analogy that's been used. It's still a good one. Even if you're paying the maximum, it's $30 for the year, and just think about that in comparison to tickets for the Lions or the Canucks. It really is quite a bargain, and the Institute can really do with your support. These are free lectures, and you have the perfect right to come without joining, but we hope that a number of you, at least a number more of you, will consider it's worthwhile joining. This is an institute which has gone now for, 80 years, Peter? 91 years we've been going. Thank you. Before I introduce the speaker, I would like to remind you that next week, next Saturday, I'm going to need some better light here. Excuse me. That's the light panel's been moved too. If I had my glasses on, I wouldn't need the light. The lecture next Saturday is Rethinking the Wealth of Nations. It's a lecture delivered by Professor Darren Ajimolu. Now, if you see it written, it doesn't look like that at all. Professor Ajimolu comes from Turkey, but fortunately for me, I was going to say to you this evening, I'll try and have the right pronunciation next week. But fortunately, we have two experts over here on Turkish pronunciation, so I'm not sure how I did, but I think I was closer than I would have been in any other scenario. So, Enarche Hologos Ein. That's the only classical Greek that I know. It has nothing to do with tonight. It actually means in the beginning was the word. But I did study classical Greek, and I don't get a chance to use it very often, so I thought I'd start out tonight. Dr. John Camp, our speaker this evening, is director of the American School of Classical Studies in Athens. He's an archaeologist and professor of classics at Ranulf-Macon College in Ashland, Virginia. Dr. Camp directs the Agora excavations in Athens, the longest continuing excavation in Greece, now, I understand, in its 75th year. The Agora, or marketplace, of ancient Athens was the center of economic, social, and intellectual life, as well as the birthplace of democracy. Dr. Camp has worked in the Athenian Agora since 1966 and directed the excavations since 1994. During the past two decades, he's developed into one of the leading authorities in Athenian and classical archaeology. He's written numerous articles and authored two books on the archaeological history of Athens and the Agora. In wandering the web, in search of additional color for this brief introduction, I note that one reviewer of his book entitled Athenian Agora, Excavations in the Heart of Classical Athens, he started his review as follows. Rare indeed is the book that one could not have wished better done. A level of compliment which must itself be rare indeed. So I'm looking forward to having a look at it with an introduction like that. Dr. Camp earned his BA from Harvard University in 1968 and his master's and doctorate in classical archaeology, both from Princeton. He was the Mellon Professor at the prestigious American School of Classical Studies at Athens from 1985 to 1996. The topic of his talk tonight is Old and New in the Agora of Athens, Birthplace of Democracy. Please join me in welcoming Professor Camp. We may ask you at some point if you can see the slides properly, and if not, we'll turn the lights a bit lower. None of us is really quite familiar with the lighting system yet. Thank you.
And also, does this sound system work? This is a different one. I'm wired. Okay? Everybody hear me? Great. We need it darker, surely.
Woo. Is that too much?
How's that? That good?
Good.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you very much, President Madden, for those kind remarks and that nice introduction. What I'm going to talk about this evening are the excavations by the American School of Classical Studies at Athens, which you see on the screen here. It's a fairly large area in downtown Athens, and this is the view you would have if you were looking at it from the Athenian Acropolis. It has taken us 75 years so far to dig it, and we're still not done yet. It's a very large and very slow project for reasons that will become clear. This is what it looked like in 1931. The whole area was a large residential neighborhood. This is the area of the excavations as they appeared before the excavations actually started. And this is a plan of the 365 modern houses that we had to remove in order to excavate what I'm going to show you. And that is why it has taken us 75 years. We ripped out 365 houses, then we had to dig down 15 to 25 feet in order to expose the ancient remains. So that means this year is the 75th anniversary of these excavations. The person responsible for much of this, and we'll see his picture in a minute, has the UBC connection that has brought me here. His name is Homer Thompson, and he was second director of the excavations from 1946 until 1968, and much of the important work was done under his leadership. He was born in Chilliwack and was both an undergraduate and a master's holder from the University of British Columbia. So that is the connection you people, or at least your area, has produced perhaps the most distinguished classical archaeologist of the 20th century. And when he got to Athens, all those houses were still there. All the papers were signed with the Greek government in 1929, and everybody was ready to go, but all the houses were still there, and there was just a little bit more bureaucracy to do. And so Homer, who at that time would have been, 25 years old, was not one to just sort of sit around and wait. So for 2 years, he went up and excavated the Pnyx, which you see here, which is the meeting place of the Athenian Assembly. And at age 25, when most of us have not yet even begun to finish our graduate degrees, he was digging a major site in downtown Athens and publishing a major study on the structure. And you see here the actual meeting place and here the step platform where the speakers to the Athenian Assembly spoke. So we're dealing with an extraordinary individual. Eventually the houses were torn down, and here you see the temple that has always crowned the hill to the west of the excavations, and here the excavations as they were in the beginning. All the dirt in those days was carried out by horse cart, and it was a real sort of Cecil B. DeMille operation with hundreds of workmen removing immense amounts of earth. This is the staff responsible. Our hero is over here. Here's Homer Thompson with the rest. At the beginning, he was not the director. He was only 25. So this is Leslie Scheer of Princeton University, who was the director, and another collection of very people who became very distinguished through their association and publication of this site. But the man we're really interested in is Homer, and down here, his wife, Dorothy Burr Thompson. What they excavated, what we are excavating, is the heart of downtown Athens. If you have on this slide here the Acropolis, essentially in the center of town, here are the fortification walls. This is a view as though you were a bird approaching Athens from the northwest at about 500 meters. And so we see here the northwest part of the fortifications and the two main city gates leading into Athens. And then a big processional way, which took you through the city and up to the Acropolis. And halfway along, you can see it sort of opens out in a great big square, and that is the Agora. It is essentially the center of town in all respects. And if we look, concentrate just on that, that processional way is going right through here. The Acropolis is up here. The city gate is way over here. And what you have is a great big open square reserved for public functions. And it varied from day to day. One day there might be an election, another day there may be an athletic contest, another day it could be used as a marketplace, the next day it could be used for a theatrical event. It was multifunctional, and the Athenians met there fairly regularly. And so what that means, of course, is it's a good place to build your public buildings. And so on the periphery of the square, on all four sides, over time, all the buildings you needed to run the Athenian democracy are somewhere in the immediate vicinity. So that we have up here the Senate building of the Athenians. And one of the things we determined digging in Athens is that nothing much has changed since antiquity except the technology. So right next to the Senate building, we have the Senate dining chamber, where the senators were fed at public expense. Adjacent to that is the archive building, chief magistrate's office down here, and essentially the buildings along this western side were the political buildings for running the city. Along the south side here was the commercial center. This building here seems to have been the Bureau of Standards, where the people in charge of the grain supply, water commissioners, the people in charge of weights and measures, had their offices. And immediately adjacent, just here on the other side of a small fountain house, is the Mint of Athens, where coins were stamped. And then here in the northeast corner of the square, this great enclosure here, supplemented by others just a few years later than the period represented on this map, were the law courts of Athens, as important in antiquity as they are today. So all the elements of the government, the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch, are all to be found in the immediate vicinity of the square. And in the excavations, the western side, the south side, and the east side have all been cleared. We are still chasing the buildings here on the northern side in order to finish off the work. Here's a picture of Homer Thompson that was taken by Life magazine 50 years ago on the inauguration of one of his major projects, which was the construction of our museum. And so he is, what is also important about this year, it's the 75th anniversary of the excavations. It is the 100th anniversary of Homer Thompson's birth. Now, he was born in 1906, I think on September 6th or September 7th, so we're almost to the day celebrating the 100th anniversary, and here he is halfway along. What he built was a building that was in ruins. You see it here. It's a long colonnaded building. It's about 116 meters long, and this is the state it's been in since the end of late antiquity. It's called, in Greek architecture, we call it a stoa. It's any colonnaded building. And after digging for several years in the 1940s, looking for a place to put a museum and finding foundations everywhere, and ancient foundations, he finally determined there was no room for a museum in the Agora unless we reconstructed an ancient building. And so he picked this one because it was big enough and because enough of it survived to allow us to restore it with absolute accuracy. And so he decided in the late 1940s, early 50s, that this is what he wanted to do. And so he cleared the remains started building it or rebuilding it. And so here you see it in about 1955, here you see it today. Finished in 1956, so yet another anniversary. This is the 50th anniversary of the reconstruction of the Stoa of Attalus. What it served as originally, and nothing has changed since antiquity, two interesting things. One is Attalus was king of Pergamon in Western Asia Minor, the area not far from Troy. But while he was still a prince, before he became king, he studied under the philosophers of Athens. And when he went home and became king, he gave the Athenians this building pretty much in appreciation of his happy college days here in Athens. So this is an alumnus gift. And again, nothing has changed. And what he gave the Athenians was a shopping mall, because behind the colonnades here, there are 21 shops, and on the second story, there are 21 more shops. And the building belonged to the state, and the shops were rented out, providing a nice income for the city. And so what you have are 42 shops on two levels under a single roof, and if that's not a shopping mall, I don't know what is. It was built originally about 150 BC, and we use it now. There are storerooms in the basement way down under here. This is the public display area, and then on the first floor we have our offices, workrooms, and additional storage. And as I say, this is all pretty much the brainchild and work of Homer Thompson, the local boy from Chilliwack, made good in the world of classical archaeology. This is what the interior looks like. These buildings are brilliantly suited to the Greek climate because, as you'll see, you have a roof over your head, whether it's very, very hot out there in summer or cold and rainy in winter, but the open colonnade allows in plenty of light and fresh air. Other things that interested him, also done in the 1950s, the little Byzantine Church of the Holy Apostles, which lay on the site, dates to about 1000 AD, and it's probably the second oldest standing church in Athens. So it was decided not to destroy that. 13 other churches now no longer exist, but this one we decided was too old and too nice to rip out with all the other ones. But it did have some ugly 19th century accretions on the end. And so all the later parts that were later than 1000 AD were taken off, and the little church was reconstructed back to its original form. And then finally, most archaeological sites left to themselves look kind of like a bomb site. They're kind of hot and dusty and hard to get around. So Homer arranged for a landscape architect, Ralph Griswold, to come over from Pittsburgh in the United States, and to landscape the entire area. And so here you see the planting plan for literally hundreds of trees and thousands of bushes, which were laid out in order to complement the ruins. And so essentially created an archaeological park. So we're going to move on now from Homer Thompson and his accomplishments, but let me just say, perhaps more than any one individual, he has redone the face of Athens, both with the excavations, with the reconstruction of the Stoa of Attalus, the fixing up of the little Church of the Holy Apostles, and the creation of an archaeological park in downtown Athens. There one last view of him. That is a good one. You can see the sharp and piercing eyes. My PhD oral exam was a piece of cake compared to the daily visits to the trench from Homer Thompson when I was digging, where he would fix you with that glaze and ask if you lit the gaze there and ask you a few embarrassing questions. and then leave you alone to think about what you didn't know for the next 2 hours. A true giant in our field, even though he stood about 5'6". Here is another view of the Agora, and we will now move on to what we've been doing in recent years. There again are the city walls and the main city gate. Here is the big processional way coming into the square, which you see here. And our excavations have concentrated, as I mentioned, on this northern side, where we have not yet got all the buildings. Where the street comes through, there are two more little stoas. Just south of the street, this little tiny stoa here is the royal stoa. And that is for the chief magistrate in charge of religious matters and the laws. And it is in that little building where Socrates will have been indicted for impiety in 399 BC. Just across the street is another stoa, this one built about 470 before Christ, and soon after it was built, decorated with a series of panel paintings on the back wall. And from that it became known as the Painted Stoa. And unlike all the other buildings in the Agora that we've been talking about, this building was built for no one group to use, no one individual, no one magistrate had priority. It was built and used as a hangout. And this is where you went when you had nothing better to do in order to spend time with your friends. So that if you were in a profession that required a crowd or an audience, you would go to the Painted Stoa because you were sure to find there a whole lot of Athenians with free time on their hands. And so jugglers, beggars, sword swallowers are all known to have hung out at the Painted Stoa. And amongst those whose trade requires a crowd are the philosophers of Athens. And in particular, the philosopher Zeno, who came to Athens from Cyprus in the years around 300 BC, and so preferred that building as his classroom and met there so regularly that he and his followers became known as the Stoics. And this is the Stoa that gives Stoic philosophy its name. We have found just the west end of the building, and we are still chasing the rest of the building, which is hiding under modern buildings. But that's for the next 40 minutes or so, half hour, we'll be talking about not the building so much as the area immediately behind it at the northwest corner of the Agora Square. This is what it looks like on a city plan. Here again is Socrates' trial building. Here is the processional way coming in. The modern Athens-Piraeus Railroad runs right through our site. The Eridanus River runs right through here. And across the street is just the end of the Painted Stoa there and the area of the new excavations just behind it. And you can see this one still has some of the modern plots that are still overlying the building. We're doing exactly what Homer Thompson had to do. We've taken out another 15 or 20 buildings. This is what it's like. You bring in a big earth mover and you just knock down the building. And then you have to dig down about 15 feet in order to get to the remains that you see coming out down below. And this is what it looks like when you're digging, pretty much like any excavation. Fairly incomprehensible. Except to those who are doing the work, but we dig with American and Canadian students, about 40 every year, come over for 8 weeks, and they're doing the work. This is a new photograph. I can tell that because in the old days, and up until 3 years ago, we used to actually hang a physical grid over the top of the site, we would have wires over there with plaques telling you exactly what square meter you were digging in. And now, instead, we have these unbelievably elaborate machines that I don't understand at all, except I know that 7 satellites are telling us exactly where we're finding that coin or that piece of pottery, and everything is done in a very, very sophisticated manner. Under the umbrella, there will be, in the shade, a supervisor who is both keeping the records and telling the students what they should be doing. And you're seeing here the uppermost levels when you first get down, and what you get first at a higher level is a whole layer of the medieval town, which was Athens in the years around 1000 AD. And here you see the main features. I want you, if you will, to keep this street in mind. There's a big north-south street running through the area that is in use here in the medieval period, and we can trace it back and dig down for about 10 feet, and it's a street all the way back to at least 500 BC. So that street was in use for 1,500 years, 2,000 years, or something like that. And on either side of it, in blue here, you're seeing the remains of private houses on either side of the street. The recovery of what allows us to date this particular neighborhood fairly well. There's a little cluster of bronze coins coming out there. Perhaps you can see them more clearly here. It's a hoard of 21 copper coins, it's the one of the few periods in the so-called Byzantine period where the emperor did not have to put his own name and his own inscription on the coin. And so they're known as anonymous foliates. And instead, what you get is a portrait head of Christ, and on the other side, the inscription, Jesus Christ, King of Kings. And this period, when they did not put their own portraits on the coins, dates from roughly 976 to 1034 AD. So the neighborhood as a whole, at a higher level, seems to date to about 1,000. Those get taken away because they're 6 to 8 feet higher up than the classical and Roman remains that we're after. And so after they're recorded very carefully, we take them out and we then go down into the area of real ancient things. And we'll start now the other way. We'll start with our earliest material and work our way toward the later. In the early period, you're seeing in green Bronze Age graves, and in red, Iron Age graves. And then on top of that, we'll start with those, on top of that in light blue, here's the end of our stoa, painted stoa. Here's the street running north-south through here. And then we'll be looking at this building just behind the painted stoa. The darker blue is later. That's what we call the Hellenistic period, around 300 BC. But so it's as always in Athens. People lived there for 5,000 years without a break. So you're getting a whole series of periods, one right on top of another. And we start back. The earliest material we found in this area are graves of the Bronze Age. And here you see two students in one of those graves and actually clearing it, digging the remains of it. This is the period, if you believe in it, certainly the classical Greeks did, of Greek mythology. If you think the Jason and the Argonauts went off to the Black Sea, if you believe in Theseus and the Minotaur, the Trojan War, Heracles, and all those things, then they took place sometime between 1500 and 1100 BC. And this particular grave dates to about 1350 to 1300. You have to give a span because in this period there are multiple graves and they're used for a whole family. You simply plant the first person in here, and then a few years later, when his wife or mother dies, you open up the same tomb, shove the bones off to the side, and put in another individual. So there'll be 7 or 8 or 10 burials in a single one of these chamber tombs, as they're called. So this is being excavated, multiple grave goods, and this is what allows us to give you the date of around 1350, good standard Mycenaean or late Bronze Age pottery. Coming out in pretty good condition. It is the Bronze Age, so that we find bronze tools and weapons. And because it's then little figurines, this enthroned lady here, fairly rare version, and she's only about 3 feet high, 3 inches high, excuse me. And then it's a closed deposit. And so here we do a lot of sieving. We don't sieve everything. We don't dig everything with dental tools because we're not missing much in most of the fill that we're digging. But if you get a closed deposit like a well or a grave, and you know that everything that was put in there should be there, then you go to a lot more trouble. And so this gets dry sieved, and it gets wet sieved through a very fine mesh, and then very labor intensive. Somebody has to go through all the goop that gets recovered once the earth has been washed away. And the reason for that is you can then recover some of the smaller material, in this case, dozens of beads of carnelian, of glass paste, and the like that make up a fairly elaborate necklace. And to give you an idea of the scale of the small beads, you can see that they're very small indeed. And so 760 beads were found, but only by going through a very labor-intensive sieving process. In the Iron Age, the succeeding period, things are much grimmer. And the tombs, here's one of them here, which has then been flooded after we dug it. Here's another one we're about to dig. They're as simple as can be, a very distinct contrast from the Bronze Age graves, which represent a fairly rich society. Now we're at a very poor period in Greek prehistory, where each of these simple shafts is just dug into the bedrock. There's no ornamentation, there are no sidewalls, only one person per grave, and almost no grave goods. And if you contrast the jewelry and the bronze material and the figurines and the dozens of pots with what comes out of one of these tombs, you will see that the level of the Athenian economy has dropped considerably in this period, which is about 300 years later, right around 1050 BC. Then we have nothing from about 1000 BC down to almost 500 BC. There's very little sign of activity in this area, and I think we're actually digging outside the early walls of Athens. And there's nothing going on until the city expands out again. It's used as only as a cemetery up until quite late times. And then the first material we get is part of the political process of Athens, and you can see a group of sherds, these broken bits of pottery scattered on the excavator's table. Every one of them carries an inscription. And what these are part of the political process that we haven't stuck with, and this may be a mistake, but this is something, a lot of what the way the Athenian democracy is recognizable to us, this is different. And what it is, it's a chance, well, I gather you guys are going through this, it's a chance to vote somebody out of office once a year, automatic. All the Athenian citizens would show up at the agora, and a simple yes or no vote was taken. Is anybody getting too big for his boots? Is anybody a pain in the ass? Is there somebody we would like out of the political arena? If a simple majority voted yes, then all the Athenians went away for 2 months, and when they came back, they brought with them their ostracon, which is the Greek word for a broken piece of pottery. And on their ostracon, they inscribed the name of the person they thought was kind of a bore or a troublemaker. And the man with the most votes lost, and he was exiled for 10 years. And that was thought to calm down any anti-democratic leanings he might have. This was instituted in 487 BC and used throughout the 5th century in order to control their most prominent politicians. And with the exception of Pericles, pretty much every prominent Athenian statesman of the early 5th century BC took one of these 10-year vacations, courtesy of the Athenian people. And these are the remnants. As soon as the vote is over, of course, they're used to grade roads, they throw them in wells, they just toss them anywhere. These ballots are very informal, and they only need to know them once, count them once, unlike Florida. And so they just throw them away once they're done. But here you can see two from that lot. And these are cast against Xanthippus, the son of Ariphrone, who was the father of Pericles, and who was thrown out of town in 484-3 BC. So we have some evidence of the political procedures going on in that particular group in 480. The next thing we have in this area is a private house, most of which doesn't survive, but what does survive and survives always in the agora is the well that provided its water, because those are shafts sunk into the bedrock 20 or 30 feet down, and when the building disappears, the shaft is still going to be there to reflect the house that it once provided. And so here you see one of our wells, and these are very popular with the students. Volunteers. Nobody has to get down one of these. If you're claustrophobic, you do not want to dig one of our wells. But if you don't mind confined spaces about a meter in diameter, then this is where you want to be, because down there it's about 55 degrees and you're up to your hips in water, and on the surface it's about 110 degrees. And so the students all try to get down into the wells if they can. The other reason it's fun to dig them is they produce immense amounts of material again, like a little time capsule. Stuff gets thrown or dropped down there, and it stays there until we dig it up centuries later. So here's the material from that well spread out with our conservator starting to put it all together. Some of it comes out intact, and the rest is there in bits and pieces. So here's a set of dinnerware for this particular house and this particular well. This one, like many of our other wells, went out of use when the Persians destroyed Athens in 480 BC. And either the Persians threw the stuff down the well, or when the Athenians came back after beating the Persians at the Battle of Salamis and started rebuilding the city, they just gathered up all the trash, because we're told by both Herodotus and Thucydides that the Persians destroyed every single building in Athens. And so they had to come back, collect all the trash, throw it down the old wells, and simply rebuild the city from scratch. And this is what we find over and over again when we're studying the pattern of the wells. We then move on, just to keep track of where we were. The well was right there. Here are our two little Iron Age graves. Here are our two Bronze Age graves. Now we're moving into the Classical period and to this building, which we identify as a shop building because, as you can see in the plan, it's a series of rectangular rooms, each with its own doorway leading directly into the street. And so the best we can assume, I think, and probably correctly, is that it's not a house, it's not a big public building, it's probably a commercial establishment and a series of shops, each with a doorway approach from the street. It's built about 400 BC and stays in use until about 100 AD. So it has a long, long life, and it's renewed and remodeled, and we have dozens of floor levels of clay as time went by and the floors build up. What they seem to be doing is selling terracotta figurines and terracotta goods, the baked clay, and collecting the material necessary to manufacture them, but not actually manufacturing them on the site. We have no kilns, we have no signs of heavy industry, but we have pieces like this, which is actually an impression taken off a metal vase that is now lost. And we get some idea of beautiful silver or bronze vases which survive now because they've all been recycled, only in these clay impressions taken in order to make terracotta or clay cheaper versions of the same thing. So we get these very fine reflections of Athenian metalwork. Here's one, and there's another. You see, this is the actual clay piece. This is the impression as it would look on the metal original and eventually on a clay copy. So we have this material suggesting some sort of manufacturing of terracottas. Here are some of the results. Here a plaque with a goddess. This is in the first century AD phase, so it's a goddess who has everything you could possibly want. It's not one recognizable goddess, because you can see she has on a helmet, which makes her look like Athena, but you can see the end of a quiver hanging on her back here, which makes her seem like Artemis. She's holding a great cornucopia here, so she's also a goddess of abundance. And behind that, you can see a wing, which makes her Nike, or the goddess of victory. So she's one of these Roman deities where pretty much everything is jammed into a single lady. And here, one of these attractive companions of Dionysus on a bad day. And other evidence of manufacture, you can see here the end of a tiny little bone stamp, which was used to stamp pottery with palmettes. And again, you can get the scale there. And lots of the pottery we have in the Hellenistic period, the early Roman period, you see these little stamps. This is one of the few instances I know of where we have the actual stamp itself made in bone. And we get molds, in this case, for a terracotta wheel. And here's the kind of wheel that would come out of, half a wheel in this case, and here's the kind of wheel that would come out of it. So as I say, we're collecting material necessary for the production of a wide variety of clay items. And we find a fair number of clay items, some of them not in very good shape, which suggests they may be the ones that never got sold. As you can see, they're sort of battered, but here repeated images of an Aphrodite figure. And this is an Aphrodite Anadyomene, which is to say Aphrodite coming out of the sea and drying her hair. So you can see she's holding out the locks of her hair to the sun and wind in order to dry them. And this is a very well-known type, starting in the 4th century BC, and apparently copies of a very famous painting by the painter Apelles. And we'll come back to these figurines and the Aphrodite in just a minute. After the classical period, after that building goes out of use, we have some very scrappy remains of the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD. And on the left side of the street, of the west side as we look at it here, some evidence that we had a Roman bath, not in very good condition. And here you can see some of that evidence. This is a group of wall tiles that are used in Roman baths. They're called tegulae mammatae because they have a cone-like or breast-like protrusion at each corner. They're 2-foot square tiles, and at the corners there'll be 4 protrusions so that when you stick it up against the wall itself, there's an air space between the wall and the face of the tiles. And hot air can circulate behind there, just the way they had hot air circulating underneath the floors. They're very, very sophisticated in how they heated their buildings. All we have are essentially the conical protrusions, so it looks like the bath was destroyed and then somebody recycled the big tiles and they just knocked off all the parts with the cones because they couldn't use those, but they used the flat middle part of the tile in some other building. But we have hundreds of the remnants of this heating system of a bath. We also have a marble seat block for a latrine. And of course, most baths had latrines. Here you can see part of essentially a keyhole-shaped cutting, which is the actual seat of the latrine there. And this block may well be the cover that goes over that hole. And if you've ever seen a Greek or early Roman latrine, it's basically a long bench with 10 or 12 of these seats placed over a deep ditch in which water was kept running pretty much all the time. And you find them in and around baths and theaters. More elegant parts of the bath, perhaps some of the sculptural decoration. You see here a head of the late Roman period that we think probably was part of a large sculptural group that once adorned the bath. Some barbarian king or something of the sort. The sculpture people are still arguing about its date and identification, but almost certainly part of the decoration of the bath. And then all this goes out of use in the 4th century AD. In 395 AD, Alaric and the Visigoths pay a visit to Athens, and the ancient sources are not clear. Some of them say that they took and destroyed the city of Athens. Others say that Achilles and Athena appeared full-armed on the walls of the city and scared them away. You can believe whichever version you want. Archaeologically, the Agora shows signs of considerable damage, but we're way outside the late Roman circuit. In this period, Athens has been destroyed already before, and the new fortification wall does not include this part of town, so it's possible we're still in the suburbs, and Alaric certainly destroyed that. So again, the same table now laid out with destruction fill of 395 AD, datable from characteristic pottery of this type here. And then in the 5th century AD, we still have our street coming through, the remains of the bath over here on this side of the street, a series of rooms, and it looks as though the function is still going on. It looks as though these rooms here, though hundreds of years later, are still primarily being used for commerce. One reason for thinking that is the doorway leading into one of these shops. You see it here. This is the threshold block that takes you into a shop from the street. And it's got a way of closing the door that's not that common in Greece. Usually in Greece, you get door pivots, and the door simply swings open or closed, or double doors swing open. In this instance, you can see a long slot running the length of the doorway, and you put a board in here and slide it along. You put a second board in here and slide it along, and you just, it's like a basically a vertical shutter. And it's very good for security. You get the last board in, you just lock that, and the door is well locked, and that's good for a shop. At the same time, when you open the door, it's going to stay open all day because it's a very cumbersome way of opening and closing things. So as I say, appropriate for a shop, not so appropriate for a house or any other function. And other suggestions that we may have commercial activity, here's the balance beam of a steel yard or a measuring system, and there are little marks all along here telling you where you should slide the counterweight in order to make the scale work. And then also to the 5th century AD, here we're looking at the street, and we're looking north. Here's, it's just gravel, successive layers of gravel. Basically in Greece, we don't pave our streets, we just put down gravel. And so what you're seeing are fresh water pipes. Here's a fresh water pipe in terracotta, here's one in lead. And then we're seeing facilities for drainage. Here is one of these rooms being drained, a little drain coming all the way across the street to dump into a great big drain that's carrying off the wastewater at a lower level. All this dating to the 5th century, but showing signs of building and rebuilding. Here's the deep drain that's carrying away all the water. Here's that subsidiary drain coming in and dumping into it. And you can see all the different types of tiles and different ways suggesting that it has been covered and recovered and built and rebuilt many times in the 5th century AD. But right up against it, where this volunteer is digging, we found a nice little figurine, and I want to show you her. There she is. She's only about 3.5 inches high, but you'll recognize her because it's our friend Aphrodite again, holding out her hair for drying. So she's exactly the same type as the terracotta figurines that we were just looking at. What's very important here is she's of a different material and she's 300 years later. So probably not the same kind of manufacturing going on. Probably the Aphrodite figures are telling us something else, and that is that they have to do with the sanctuary of Aphrodite, which we've always suspected lay nearby. But this type of Venus or Aphrodite drying her hair is a very popular one. Here she is by Titian in the National Gallery in Edinburgh, and lots of artists have turned their attention to this scene. Here is the altar we would like to believe on the basis of Pausanias's description of Athens in about 150 AD. He describes a series of buildings near the stoa, painted stoa, one of them a sanctuary of Aphrodite. We have the altar. Here is our street going out. Here is the royal stoa where Socrates is indicted. Here is the painted stoa. Here is our street starting up, and we're now digging just in here. There is the altar, which we believe from Pausanias' description is that of Aphrodite. And now when we look at our assemblage of Aphrodites, all of them drying their hair, they now span 300 years, and they're made in two different materials, terracotta and ivory, so more likely that they're votives or gifts made at and for that sanctuary than that they're manufacturing process represented by the other material found in that commercial building. And then toward the end, we'll come now to the end of the use of this area before we have a dark age again. And what we have here is a gold coin. And gold coins in the Agora are extremely rare. We have 80,000 coins, and I think we have 8 gold ones. So the ratio is about 1 in 10,000. Or the other way you can put it is I've worked there 40 years. And I have seen 3 gold coins found. So the odds are not good of finding a gold coin. And the story clearly is that if you dropped a gold coin, you looked for it until you found it again. This one here dates the time of the Emperor Leo, which is to say for the 450s up to 474 AD, I think it is, the second half of the 5th century AD. And that is a time when one ancient source says that the Vandals attacked Athens. And about 10 meters away from this gold coin 10 years ago, we found 471 bronze coins, all also attributed to the Emperor Leo. Now we have this gold coin here that somebody dropped and didn't pick up, and a good reason not to stop and pick it up if you're being chased by vandals. And so we think we're gradually accumulating evidence for a vandal destruction of Athens in the 460s or 470s. So this is what we've been doing. We've been looking at this street here, the altar of Aphrodite, the commercial building behind it. Here is the end of our painted stoa. You can see there are seven buildings overlying it still. This plan is an old one. We've now ripped out that house. We've ripped out this house. We've torn down that house. We've torn down this house. And we're about to tear down that one. So we only have this one and that one to go. And we will have cleared the property. And we still have to dig it in order to find the rest of the painted stoa. Then we'll need to cut the street here. And then in theory, we will have done what we set out to do 75 years ago, which is to expose all the public buildings facing onto the Great Square. To go back a moment to Homer Thompson and his work, we occasionally go back into the old area and fuss with problems or things we want to worry about. And last year, we went to examine this building here, which had tentatively been identified as the Strategion, or the general's headquarters, right near the Senate building where it had a lot of business and an important public building in the running of the state. The identification is not absolutely certain, and some people on our staff thought it might be something else, that maybe it's better understood as a commercial building, another shop building, not unlike the one we're just looking at. So we went back to see if we could find more evidence for whether it was the general's building or possibly a shop building. The site was originally dug by Homer Thompson and his colleagues in the 1930s, and it's right in here. You can see the Stoa of Attalus in the background to get your bearings. It's right in here. And they got down to the floors, and they were so busy digging, there's so many other things, and the building is in a horrible state of disrepair that they didn't go any farther than just to the floors of the building. So we hoped if we dug underneath the floors, we might get more evidence for its use. And within 3 inches below where they had left it in 1937, we found this great accumulation that you see here, which is actually 15 pounds of silver coins all mushed together. And they had been buried in a pit underneath the floor of the building. And it represents quite a lot of money. Altogether, it's about, they're tetradrams, they're 4 drachmas each, and a drachma was a day's wage in those days. And it's 1,600 drachmas, 400 tetradrams. So we're talking about somewhere between $250,000 in antiquity, and probably about that today. But in any case, dating probably to about 300 BC, somebody buried them under the floor of the building and then never got a chance to go back and retrieve them. But you can see them, they come out of the ground in very good shape, so you can see the owl and the inscription Alpha Theta Epsilon for the beginning of the word Athens, and there'll be a sprig of olive over here, and then on the other side, the head of Athena. And these are still just being studied and worked on to determine, if we can, when they were all buried, who buried them, and why. I'm showing them to you just so to answer the question that I get a great deal that I hate to get, and that is, haven't you already found everything yet? And the answer is no. This was just missed by our predecessors by about 3 inches 60 years ago, and there's a lot more work still to be done in the old area as well as the new. This is your cast of characters as it would have been in the 1930s. When it was primarily Greek workmen that were used with the American staff, including Homer Thompson in the middle here. Things haven't changed much, except now we use mostly American students as our victims, but the results are pretty much the same, and that is my report on the excavations at the Athenian Agora. Thank you very much.
question is, have we dug at the theater? And the answer is no. We have a concession to dig a certain area, and we are way beyond the limits of that already, but it doesn't go as far as the theater. We were originally allowed to dig up to the railroad tracks, and then when we didn't find the northern side, we were allowed to go up to modern Hadrian Street, and when we still failed to find the northern side, we were allowed to go up to the next street. But we are supposed to only be concerning ourselves with the civic center of the city. Yeah? The question is, what is the population of Athens from 600 BC to 300 AD? And the answer is, we don't have any idea at all. And you can read book after book after book of attempts to do it. We fuss with a lot of different ways. The size of the military is a good way to do it, how big the armies were, how many men you needed for the fleet if you're going to send out 150 triremes. They fussed with food production and food import and how much grain you need, and things of that sort. There are a handful of ancient sources that tell you a little bit about how many citizens there might have been at one time or another, and then you have to factor in how many women, how many children, how many non-Athenian Greeks, how many slaves. And you want to multiply your figure by 6, by 10, by 12. So there are wildly varying figures. I would imagine that the total population of Athens and its territory is somewhere between 300 and 500,000. But that's a lot of people would disagree with that. Yeah?
How was this handled to get rid of the current or the recent residents?
Wondering how we get rid of the recent residents. we shoot most of them. No. It was part of a major rebuilding urbanization project, and we try to buy the property on the open market, and if they don't sell, then eminent domain comes in. The Greek government expropriates the property, but we pay for it. So the Greek courts decide, and so what will happen is we will go into court and say, this is an archaeological zone. Nobody is ever going to buy this property. It's absolutely worthless. And they go in and say, this is prime real estate in downtown Athens. It's worth $16 jillion. And then the judge decides a figure between those two ridiculous positions. And that's what we pay. For the most part, it's not residential. It's just people. It's non-resident landlords. And it's commercial property. So we're not throwing the little ladies into the street or anything like that. So there's a set procedure for doing it. And they are compensated quite well. Yeah?
When did they stop the sense of the people in office? When did they stop?
Oh, when did they? The question is, when did they stop ostracism? The trouble with ostracism, the answer is 417. And the reason is that ostracism is a neat idea, but if number one is actually strong enough, it's a great way to get rid of number two. So if you're politically strong enough, you have all your opponents, all your supporters vote against your opponent, and you can get the other guy thrown out of town, which is pretty cool. In 417, it was Alcibiades and Nicias, and we're in the middle of the Peloponnesian War, and they both decided they couldn't live with each other as an opponent, and so they agreed to have, they arranged to have an ostracism while their supporters voted to have one, and then just before the second vote, when it was actually going to happen, they both lost their nerve because there were no public opinion polls. It wasn't clear who was going to lose. And so they got together and they ganged up on number three, Hyperbolus, and they threw him out of town. And this was such an obvious perversion of the system that, as far as we know, they never used it again. Yep. Yeah, the coinage. The question about the coinage is, Athens, was it locally mined? The answer is yes. In South Attica, about 40 miles from downtown Athens, there are huge silver mines, which were used to build the fleet that defeated the Persians at Salamis. So the Athenians had very fine silver sources. No gold and not much copper, but plenty of silver. You have a question up there?
A long period of time where these buildings are being destroyed and rebuilt.
guess the question is, I'm showing a period of turmoil over so many centuries, and the question is, how did the text survive? The first thing I would say is the turmoil is not as great as I present it, because I just gave you 1,500 years of history, and it really did take as long for 100 years to go by in antiquity as it does today, so that each one of those demolitions is 100 years apart, from the Herulians in 267 to Alaric in 395 to the Vandals in, whatever, 470 to the Slavs in 582. So it's not all turmoil. Athens itself was a great center of learning, and what they had official sets of the plays of Euripides in their archive building. And because it's a great cultural center in the Hellenistic period after Alexander the Great, when you get the huge libraries at Pergamon and at Alexandria, there are copies kept there. Alexandria, of course, burns, and most of the Pergamon library goes down to replace it. So there are a lot of these texts in Egypt where conditions are far better for the preservation of material, just in terms of conditions, so that the texts are more likely to survive longer. And then people copy them, and they copy them again and again and again and again, and the people in the monasteries start copying them. And it's the monks in the early Christian world. And it's not surprising, of course, all those monks there, that I think of all the classical texts we have more versions of Ovid's Ars Amatoria, I think, than we do of anything else. So you know what the monks were interested in. But occasionally they did Pausanias or something else as well. But there is a whole sort of history of manuscripts and their survival. And there's enough opportunity. Yeah. What's most surprising or delightful about excavating there? It's no one thing. It's a process, not an event. I think the most interesting thing was a building we took 2 years to dig, and it turned out what we think it is a late Roman philosophical school, which was then taken over by the Christians. When in 529 AD the Emperor Justinian forbade any pagan to teach philosophy in Athens. We don't turn Christian overnight. We're a very pagan city, as you saw Aphrodite drying her hair there in 400 AD. I found it interesting. I would not have known what to ask for if I wanted to see physical evidence for a shift from paganism to Christianity. But in this house we did it with how they threw away sculpture, how they rearranged a mosaic, lamps with crosses in the later periods, this, that, and the other thing. But it's more the intellectual challenge than any. A find, once you've analyzed the find, is then just a headache to restore and to conserve and to keep safe. So unless it's an inscription, you don't really want to find too many things. Sir?
During the large reconstruction,
The question is, what did they find in preparation for the Olympics with all the construction that was done around Athens? They put in a metro system, and that has 22 stations, but only three of them fall within the walled area of ancient Athens. And they found lots of things, but nothing that changed our notion of the history of the city. When they did the equestrian grounds out near the airport, they found 28 different sites, and they dug them carefully. They recorded them. And if you go to the Athens airport, now has its own museum showing you the things found in those excavations. So they found things, but I don't think they found anything that has altered our view of Athens appreciably. They certainly didn't destroy anything of significance. Yeah? Did the processional road lead to Piraeus? No, it leads to a building just inside the city gates. And then the wall just continues out toward northwest Greece. It takes you through a pass in the mountains to Eleusis. Excuse me, that's a lie. The sacred way goes there. I'm not sure where that big road goes, but it does not go to Piraeus. There's another gate to the south of those west of the Agora, behind the temple, that is the gate there is called the Piraeus Gate, and that's the road that goes down to the Piraeus. The other ones lead northwest out of town and primarily toward Eleusis.
Yeah?
Do you have an idea what might be below the current excavations?
Do we know what's below the current excavations? For the most part, we do, because we're almost on bedrock. And most of these buildings have dirt floors, so you can leave the walls and dig under the floors and see what's there, like those graves. Those graves are underneath the 5th century building, so we can dig them and then just fill them back in again to the floor level of the 5th century BC building. So in effect, we can have our cake and eat it too. We leave our Roman buildings and we leave our Greek buildings, but we dig down under their dirt floors to see what's there in the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. We get to bedrock and then we fill it up again. It's very hard to say because of bureaucracy and funding, and you cannot imagine the things, you probably can, that how confusing it is to dig in a modern capital in the Mediterranean country. But all things going the way they should, 15, 20, 25 years. We dig much slower now than we used to. You saw that cast of 200 men. They moved a great deal more earth. Students dig much slower, but they also dig more carefully. So the pace at which we dig is much slower than it used to be. I don't plan to. We'd have to see how much of it's preserved. And the beauty of the Stoa of Attalus is we are correct in 92% of what we did. Most buildings, we couldn't be anywhere near that sure of how it looked, in which case then you're dealing with Disneyland or the world of virtual reality and things that we don't do. There's a lot more reinforced concrete in the modern one than there was in the ancient one. But the marble you saw was quarried from the same mountain. The limestone was taken from the same quarries down in Piraeus. The roof tiles were fired pretty much in the ancient methods. So that is as close to a replica of the original building as you're likely to ever see. Yes, some of it is embedded and incorporated into it. Absolutely, you can see the difference. It's been designed so you can do that. Absolutely. Yeah? The paintings in the painted stoa, we're not going to get those. They were on wooden boards. And Pausanias, they went up in, let's say, 470, 60 BC. Pausanias, 600 years later, in 150 AD, can describe four of them for us. And they're scenes showing Athenian military exploits, both mythological and historical. That's in 150 AD. When the Bishop Synesius visits Athens in 400 AD, he's really annoyed because there are no paintings in the painted stoa. They've all been taken away by a Roman proconsul. So they've been plundered before the end of antiquity. So if they're going to be found, they're not going to be found there. Yeah? What happened to the medieval remains when we removed them? They disappear. All we're dealing with, for the most part, are the walls or the foundations of walls, and they are field stones set in clay or mud. So if you leave them, they will melt, or you have to reconstruct them in concrete or cement. And so for the most part, we record them. We take their pictures, we draw them, we love them, we leave them for 2 or 3 years while we study them. And then we just take them out. But there's no, it ends up being a pile of stones and some dirt once we've done it. There are no cut blocks, and there's not much to look at, I should say, except and what are mostly foundations under the floor levels of fairly scrappy houses. And we're making a decision, which archaeologists always have to make: what is the strength of your site? And what are you digging for? If I was really interested in the Byzantine world, I'd probably want to dig Salonika or Constantinople, just the way at Mycenae, there was a whole Hellenistic city sitting right on top of all those Bronze Age remains, and they were removed because the great strength of Mycenae is the Bronze Age. So you have a responsibility to care about the other periods, but inevitably you're going to go for one period or another. Yeah?
The wall, right.
The The question is the fortification walls that I showed. The answer is the circuit was built by Themistocles in 479. They were destroyed at the end of the Peloponnesian War. And then within 10 years, by 395, Conon had won an important sea battle off Cnidos and was already rebuilding the wall. So they were rebuilt very soon after their destruction.
Along the same lines?
Same lines, exactly. Yep. Yep. Sorry?
What material is used for the books?
It's papyrus or vellum. Yeah.
I wonder if you're working off with any Greek archaeologists on
the site. Do we work? No, we work under their supervision, but and this is true of all the foreign schools. They're given a certain number of permits a year to dig in Greece, and they run the sites as they see fit, but always under the supervision of the Greek Archaeological Service. But the service is responsible for rescue excavations all over Athens, and they are tremendously taxed with what they have to do by law. So, and they have their own sites that they dig. So they watch what we're doing, and we consult with them, but we put up the money and the labor and basically design how we're going to dig any given year. Yeah. What happened during the excavation work, during the occupation? We did not dig for about 5 or 6 years. No more than that. It was basically 39 to 48 or 47, 48. The site was abandoned, but some of the Greek workmen looked after it. One American didn't leave until he was sent off to a concentration camp. He stayed in Athens and minded the site for a while. Not much damage was done. We were lucky. Some places, the sites got rearranged. Usually it wasn't stealing antiquities. It was people desperate for firewood would go in and take the boxes that the material was stored in. Because they needed the firewood and things of that sort. We did have one person, we had a huge shaft about 2 meters in diameter, and we put a wooden cover over that so people wouldn't fall into it, and somebody stole the cover and fell in. But basically the site was left alone and did not suffer much damage at all, which is not true of other sites in Greece. Yeah. Two more questions, I'm told. Yes. Everything we find belongs to the Greek state, and it all goes into that museum. We have the intellectual property responsibility, but the material belongs to the Greek state. One more? Which one? Yes. The question is, do we find ordinary burials? In cemeteries, yes, you do. And from about 600 BC until 400 AD, somewhere around there, you could not bury within the city walls of Athens. So the cemeteries are outside the walls. The major cemetery is being excavated by the Germans down by the Kerameikas, but other cemeteries are found in public works all over the city all the time. We don't have any. We have either Bronze or Iron Age, or we have very late burials. And that's it, I believe.
Before I call on Professor Hector Williams from the Classical Studies Department at UBC to thank our speaker, I've been asked by Peter Nemetz to say that you've been such a good audience that coffee and cookies will be provided upstairs, where presumably you'll have the chance to question each other on what you learned this evening. Thank you. Hector.
Mr. President and ladies and gentlemen, last spring when our department, Classical Near Eastern and Religious Studies, was looking for a way to mark the centenary of the birth of Canada's most distinguished archaeologist, Homer Thompson, who died at the age of 94 in the year 2000, we thought immediately of asking Professor John Camp to come to speak to us about the Agora. Professor Camp worked with Professor Thompson for many years. In fact, I think it was Homer Thompson that brought John into the Agora in 1966, so he's celebrating 40 years there. And I think you'll all agree that this evening we had ample justification for our decision to invite Professor Kemp to come to talk to us. In less than an hour, he summarized 1,500 years of activity in the heart of Western civilization in one of the most important archaeological sites in the world. I hope that he has inspired you to visit Athens. For those of you who are younger, to study archaeology, UBC has one of the great traditions of archaeology in Canada. Our department has excavations now in Sicily, Greece, Turkey, Syria, and Egypt, all going on. And as long as I have some position in the Vancouver Institute, I think you'll hear about them from time to time, or from other excavations in other areas. Professor Kemp has many other strings to his bow as well. He is a trustee of the Archaeological Institute of America, and with his permission, I'm throwing in a commercial here for that organization, which has almost 10,000 members across Canada and the States, including a chapter here in Vancouver with nearly 100 members. The program is available out by the door, and you're all invited to our first lecture of the year on UBC excavations in Egypt on the 26th of September. So with great thanks, I turned to you to ask you to express the usual tribute to our speaker for a superb presentation this evening.